He would much rather live to witness its death. The problem was, between the heavens and the city below, he had nowhere else to hide. He fumbled with the hilt of his chainsaw.
Come for me then, beast!
A flak shell detonated beneath the Haradin's exposed belly, eliciting a howl of pain. Another burst nearby. The gunners on the ground were finding their range, the shrapnel scoring Xenos flesh and the flank of Esau's battle plate alike. Seizing upon the moment of distraction, he veered off hard to the right, but the Haradin lunged for his outstretched legs and turned inside of his tightest possible trajectory, carrying it clear of the interceptor fire. From there, it would easily snatch him up in its jaws. It roared as it made to lunge again. The box crackled in Esau's ear. Without looking back, he folded and dropped just as Brother Galerius opened fire from above him and in the opposite direction. A flurry of bolt pistol shots tore into the Haradin's plated hide as the veteran soared over Esau's shoulders, keeping tight to its outstretched neck. Almost as an afterthought, he struck at the great beast's crested skull with his own blade as he passed, chipping the bony armor, causing the monster to recoil and howl in annoyance. Esau raised his helm.
Oh, you've really got its attention now!
Steady your descent! Between us, we'll lead it back into range of the guns!
The other warrior fired his pack and rolled away to the left. Sure enough, the Haradin bellowed its fury and swept down to give chase, snapping at his heels.
By the Quakers and Holy Teeth, be quick about it, brother!
Not daring to question his good fortune, nor how Galerius had escaped from the gunship, Esau drew his own pistol and re-angled himself to follow in the creature's wake. The veteran had given up trying to taunt it, instead using every reflex he possessed to keep just a few meters ahead of its jaws, and so Esau stung its rear quarters with a handful of well-aimed shots. As the single-minded creature recoiled, he overshot it, trading places with Galerius once more.
This way! Make for the tall haps!
The cityscape of Camuero spread from horizon to horizon beneath them. Esau could see winged Xenos creatures flocking between the spires, though they were outnumbered by the sheer hordes of Tyranids engaged against the human defenders on the ground. Firefights raged in the streets, with every intersection becoming a contested kill zone. But it was the anti-air support that the two sides were counting on. Goaded by their bolt shots and carefully timed crisscrossing flight paths, the Haradin breached the effective ceiling of the ward district's emplaced guns for the second and final time. Autocannon fire pierced its wings in a dozen places and scored red blooms in the softer meat of its belly. Flak shells tore through its bony armor, shredding its muscles. The beast spasmed in the air once, twice, then folded to one side and went limp. Its bulky carcass sailed down past Esau as he jinked away from another trail of interceptor fire. He spared it a backward glance as it crashed through the upper levels of a municipal stack, hurling shattered masonry to the choked roadways below, before slewing through the glassaic roof of a squat administrative building. He turned to Galerius, who was arcing around in a wide descending circle overhead, and they exchanged a clenched salute of victory. Esau smiled grimly behind his visor, looking back to where the Haradin lay with its spine broken amidst the rubble, and opened a vox channel.
This is Brother Esau, at the scythe of the Emperor, to local Procoran forces. Good shooting. We will confirm the kill. If you could cease firing at us now, we would very much appreciate it.
To his surprise, the channel chimed with a response almost instantly.
Brother Esau, this is Apothecary Aratus. Forget looking for Xenos trophies. We must evacuate immediately.
Less than half a kilometer from the ruined administratum building was the temporary facility established by the chapter for recruit screening. Though gunfire echoed through the streets outside and great campanile bells tolled in warning, within the armored walls of the strongpoint could still be found a measure of safety from the Tyranid invaders. Heavy auto turrets built into the gate approaches tracked back and forth, readily able to distinguish Esau and Galerius from potential Xenos infiltrators. Apothecary Aratus met them at the barricaded entrance, at the top of a wide set of stone steps. Empty shell casings and gritty debris crunched underfoot. The apothecary looked from one warrior to the other, and back again. He frowned.
Is this it, Galerius? Where's the rest of your squad? Where is Brother Sergeant Cassander?
Galerius mag-sheathed his chainsword and removed his laureled helm, gulping at the dusty air. The entire left side of his face was swollen and blistered, the neck seal of his battle plate evidently broken by the fire on board the Storm Eagle.
We were intercepted before we even made our combat drop. Damned Xenos snatched the gunship right out of the air.
He ran his tongue over his teeth and spat a gobbet of red-tinged saliva onto the steps.
I've never seen anything like it. These beasts are fast, faster than usual, and agile too. Young Isao and I barely made it down here.
Aratus sagged, casting a glance back over his shoulder into the requisitioned building's interior.
It's Daedalus, the hive ship. Its broods are hyper-evolved for flight and aerial engagements. Who knows what kind of prey worlds it must have feasted on to achieve that level of genic specialization. I've been here since before the invasion began, but these winged hordes seem to be without end. Honestly, there is no way that the defenders can hold out much longer. It is regrettable. We had over 100 potential recruits, far more than the gene seed stocks I brought with me.
He turned to Isao.
And I realized I know you too, brother. Your name sounded familiar. I fitted your eye after Miral Prime. You've come a fair way since then, though. How's it serving you?
Isao did not remove his helmet. He wanted to maintain some distance from the apothecary for the purposes of their mission, and just a little emotional detachment, even if fate seemed determined to test him in that regard.
It is an acceptable replacement. You have my gratitude. The focus is sharp, the resolution of the picked captures more than adequate. I would say, however, it feels a little small in the socket. May I ask, where did you obtain it?
Aratus pursed his lips.
You don't really want to know the answer to that, brother. Come now, we're wasting time.
He led them into the strong point, through a grand reception hall now fallen to ruin, then past rooms filled with empty archive shelves and uneven rows of scribe stations. Galerius twitched at the sight of civilians cowering in the unlit recesses.
What was this place? Before you arrived, what was its purpose? It seems too well defended to be a librarium, too scholarly for a Medicaid center.
Aratus did not turn.
A local precinct house for the Adeptus Arbites. The Sector Marshal turned it over to us without question when we arrived.
Slowing at one of the many side alcoves to examine the defaced statue of an Imperial Saint bearing a symbolic set of scales, Isao noted the scraps of parchment trodden into the tiled floor by innumerable feet.
But there haven't been any arbitrators stationed here for some time, by the looks of things.
No, there was some sort of uprising on Brachor Dominus a few years ago, and the enforcers from this precinct house were reposted to the system's cardinal world instead. Although I don't know as that will help now, once the Kraken reaches them.
The bells still pealed out their alarum from the towers far above. The apothecary halted at a secure door and punched a code into the lock.
Look, I didn't know if the chapter would get here in time, so I worked out the best exit strategy I could. As it happens, it seems that's all we have left. There's an Onager lighter craft on standby on the pad above us. It's been out of action since the arbitrators left. I got a couple of local techs to get it running again, in exchange for passage off-world with us. I hope they don't think it too raw a deal when they find out Chapter Master Thracian's policy on refugees.
The door clanked open to reveal a step down into a cell block annex. Four anxious-looking human serfs in a mixture of Medicaid garb and surplus security gear jumped to their feet, clearly charged with protecting the two sealed cryo-caskets in the center of the low chamber. Galerius shot Isao a cautious look. The gene seed. This was their primary objective. Aratus gestured to one of his attendants.
Nalyatov here has flight training. Says he can get us to a rendezvous with the Atreides. Recall your Storm Talon escorts and we'll make a run for it right now.
Galerius sighed, replacing his helmet.
I doubt that's possible.
We lost track of them on the way down. If they survived the attack, they would likely have returned to the Atreides, beyond comms range.
The apothecary rounded on them.
You lost track of your escort gunships?
We had other things on our mind, brother. Like the Xenos brood mothers trying to rip us to pieces.
Aratus glared at him, then became aware that Galerius had stepped quietly to inspect the gene seed containers. The apothecary edged between them, also shielding the closest of his trembling human aides.
I know what this is, brothers. I know you're only here for the cryo caskets. And if there's room for Brother Aratus, then so much the better, yes? I've been in your position before, tasked by Thracian to ensure the future of the Scythes of the Emperor above all else. But you tell me your gunship is gone, and your squad too. The only orbital craft we still have can carry the gene seed, all of us, and the two techs as well. Why do you need to leave these honored servants to die? Their years of expertise lost just because your mission parameters did not include their survival.
He drew up straighter, placing a proprietorial hand upon one of the caskets. Through the frosted glass, the dark shadows of its contents could almost be seen.
Just because we are ordered to do something does not make it right.
Esau glanced around the annex, his conscience prickled. The apothecary's words made sense. Esau could feel the eyes of these helpless mortals upon him, and upon the chainsword at his hip. He looked at Galerius. The veteran shrugged.
We would still be completing our mission as stated.
They were evidently of the same mind. Aratus nodded, but let out a long sigh as he took up his own chainblade and helm.
Well, brothers, we're all goodly souls after all. The problem is, the Onaga is an unarmed cargo lighter, and the second of Daedalus's Harridan spawn you brought with you is still circling the city like it has your scent. The Defense Force gunners reported us too high for them to engage. Without an escort, we'll be easy prey once we get anywhere near it.
Esau eyed their precious cargo. Not only the cryo caskets, but the human serfs, too.
We could leave to Moero airspace and find a clearer path to orbit. That's how we came in.
Galerius shook his head.
The smaller Tyranid swarms would be all over us in minutes. We need cover from the ground to get us anywhere near the stratosphere. That's assuming the repaired lighter holds out and our man Nalyatov doesn't steer us into a hab spire on the way up.
He nodded towards the surf.
No offense, Nalyatov.
Esau took a deep breath. He thought of Cassander, Sorgon, and the others, and he knew what had to be done.
Well, we aren't escaping anything stood down here. Let's break for orbit under cover of the interceptor guns, and we'll deal with the Xenos as and when.
The three space marines threw out their fists in the old Sothan Reaper's salute, and Galerius drew his pistol.
Aye, we will be the blade, brother.
The Onaga was a variant of the workhorse Arvus-class shuttle, found in naval service across the length and breadth of the Imperium. Though it was unclear how this battered old specimen had ended up on the landing pad of a Brakuran precinct house. The cargo hold was far smaller than that of a Chapter Storm Eagle, and built for mortal dimensions. Even so, the serfs had managed to cram the two bulky cryo caskets in behind the pilot's compartment, while they themselves filled the bench seats down either side. They fastened stale rebreather masks over their mouths and noses, against the risk of decompression at altitude or in the near void. The engines guttered and strained as the craft lifted off. From where he stood astride one of the secured containers, with his bare head and armored shoulders filling the tight observation dome in the ceiling, Aratus's attention was stolen away. A huge, flaring blast of green bioplasma lit up the sky some 3 kilometers to the west.
Throne! The perimeter of the Third Ward has fallen!
Galerius and Esau were crouched one behind the other towards the back of the shuttle, right up against the sealed drop ramp. Their bulky jump packs prevented them from standing at all, or indeed turning around in the narrow confines of the hold. And so they had edged in backwards to face out with Esau in the rearmost position. Just in case. Unable to see what the apothecary was seeing, he called back into the hold behind him.
What's going on out there? Do we still have our route?
The city was being overrun, in scenes that were doubtlessly being played out all over the besieged continent. This was the beginning of the end for Brakur IV. Soon the defenders' guns would fall silent beneath the weight of the Kraken's assault, both on the ground and in the air. But not yet. Nalyatov struggled to haul the Onaga around. The force of their rumbling ascent dragging on their bodies as the shuttle slowly began to climb and gather speed. A huge explosion at street level, a few blocks away, tore through the foundations of one of the immense, tottering spires. The structure sagged as it fell, streaming rubble and what might have been tiny, flailing bodies from the uppermost levels. Vast clouds of masonry dust billowed out over the city beneath them, forcing the surf pilot to bank hard away. The ever-present thunder of the guns grew as the shuttle climbed further still. Shrieking flocks of winged creatures filled the air, yet the Onager used the covering fire to find a path through them. The hold was soon lit by the bright Brakuur suns through the crystal-flecked dome over Aratus's head. They had broken the cloud cover into the skies beyond. Only now there were scores of fiery contrails streaking towards the surface, if not hundreds. The next overwhelming stage of Daedalus's assimilation of this doomed world. The apothecary darted his gaze left and right, scanning the horizon.
Nalyatov, head south-southwest, engines to maximum. Keep trying to raise the Atreides. I don't see how...
He froze, his eyes widened.
By the Reapers, Grin, that beast is huge! Harrod and Broodmother, coming right at us out of the sun! Take evasive action!
Over the howl of the engines, as the Onager veered unevenly from side to side, the approaching creature's roar could be heard even within the sealed hold. Galerius thumped the metal-grilled floor in frustration.
Damn it, you can't outrun it in this old wreck! We need to strike now if we're going to have any sort of chance.
Esau gritted his teeth and reached for the ramp controls, releasing the locks.
This is it, brothers! Honored servants, strap in tight and close your eyes. That's an order!
As soon as the ramp lowered even just a few centimeters, the roar of depressurization became one with the roar of the wind. Up here, the air was thin. Galerius wrapped Esau on the back of his leg.
Are you sure about this? We can take it together, just like the first one.
Esau kept his eyes on the steadily falling lip of the ramp, revealing the riven sky beyond.
No, brother! Your pack's reserves won't last long enough to bring you back, even if we did. And if all else fails, I'll lead it away from the shuttle. They will need you here in case anything worse comes along afterwards.
The veteran let out an exasperated cry, then rapped on his leg again.
Fine. But you are a terrible liar, Esau. Now get ready.
The Harridan swept into view. The old, familiar hatred began to growl in Esau's gullet at the sight of it, gaining rapidly, beating its wings hard to match the Onager's slewing flight. He could even make out the gaps in its fanged maw where Sergeant Cassander's pack had mauled it. With a hydraulic clank, the ramp locked open. The beast roared. Esau kicked up hard with both legs, launching himself straight towards it. He flew through the air like an armored missile, not even needing to fire his jump pack to carry him from the shuttle's open bay. The Harridan actually flinched as he hurtled past its head and over the left wing, faltering for just a moment before diving on after the Onager. And then Esau was past it, tumbling down in the wake. He struggled to turn himself against the weakly rising thermals. He realized that he had misjudged the leap, and now faced another plunge to the surface of Brakuur 4. He had failed. The Harridan was only seconds away from the fleeing shuttle, slowed by the drag of its open ramp. Then, in a moment of apparent insanity, Esau saw his chance. He fired his turbines, shooting forwards and ramming himself bodily into the Harridan's serpentine back, right behind the hunch of its broad, pinioned shoulders. He barely managed to grab hold of the horned chitin plates protecting its spine. The creature thrashed from side to side, howling and bellowing, bucking its body like an unbroken, monstrous steed as it tried to dislodge him. Esau held on as tightly as he could, only then realizing that he had not planned anything beyond this last, desperate act. He bellowed at his reluctant new mount.
I'm going nowhere! You'll not shake me! I'll steer you into the ground if I have to!
He caught movement at the corner of his vision. From between the segmented plates on the beast's back, smaller creatures were spawning into the battle. These grotesque newborn gargoyles hooted and hissed as they pulled themselves free with withered claw limbs, regarding Esau as a threat to their broodmother and nesting place, if nothing else, and swarming over its undulating hide towards him.
Get back, you filth!
Esau kept his grip with his left hand and drew his chainsword from its sheath clasp. He swiped at the closest gargoyle, cleaving the head from its scrawny neck letting the limp body tumble away. More of them came, firing their weapon analogs and spitting angry yellow globs of bioacidic drool that flew wide in the rushing wind. He slashed at them again and again. Even so, there were too many of them. They could rush him in numbers, dragging his grip away and casting him to the air once more. From the shuttle, Galerius called out over the box.
Esau, you magnificent madman! Let us take some of these horrors off your platter!
The open cargo hold lit up with the muzzle flare of bolt pistol shots, joined a moment later by someone's plundered las carbine. Accuracy was virtually impossible, and such small arms could never hope to harm a beast like the Harridan. But they kept it agitated and off balance. And they could harm the gargoyles. A bolt shell blasted one creature apart at Esau's shoulder, spattering his visor with Xenos blood. And another was winged as it tried to scramble out of harm's way. Aratus was speaking to the pilot.
Brothers, we are running out of time. Naliatov reports more winged Terranid warrior forms converging from the north. We must flee for the Gene Seed's sake.
Resigned to his fate, Esau gestured to the heavens.
I have this apothecary. I will distract the beast and lure it away myself. Close the ramp and head for the rendezvous.
Go well, brother. You will not be forgotten.
Esau braced his feet and hauled himself up with one hand. He kept his profile as low as he could to lessen the immense buffeting of the wind, holding his chainsword tightly and eyeing the flexing alien musculature of the Harridan's back. He was trying to picture the sinuous movements of the creature's flight as it dived after the onager, waiting for the optimum moment to make his escape. He paused. With each downward beat of its wings, he saw the Harridan's exoskeletal plates separate by just a few fingers' breadth to reveal the taut cartilage beneath. It was a narrow gap. Would it be enough?
Wait, Aratus! I'm going to try something!
Make it fast! 60 seconds to enemy intercept!
Confirmed! Have Naliatov ready for full thrust on my mark!
Esau pulled the strap of frag grenades from his belt. They were intended to maim and disperse lightly armored infantry, or clear a drop site, but he fancied that all three stuffed into an enclosed space could hurt even a Tyranid of this great size. He added his only crack charge for good measure. But he would need to time it perfectly. He counted down under his breath.
5, 4, 3, arm, and drop! Go, go, go!
He thrust the grenades in, dropped his chainsword, crossed his arms in front of his visor, and pushed as hard as he could off the Harridan's back. The wind jerked him away in an instant. All four charges detonated at once. Shards of bloody chitin flew through the air, the great beast howling as the blast sheared through the joint of its foreshoulder. The right wing buckled and folded, and the Harridan contorted around the wound, enraged and agonized in equal measure. Its writhing convulsions dislodged many of its gargoyle brood, scattering more of them to the wind, bleating in fear. Esau ignited his jump pack in a short burst to carry him clear above the disoriented flock, then leveled out. The Harridan tried to right itself, sweeping both wings down hard. The strain was too much. With a sickening, meaty snap, its damaged pinion broke clean off at the shoulder in a welter of vital fluids.
Yes. Fall, you abomination!
Esau and his brethren spat curses after the crippled broodmother as it went whirling to destruction, the cheers of the human passengers clearly audible over the open vox channel. The lone warrior hung in the rarefied air, on the border between sky and the low void beyond it, and watched the onager shuttle powering away from him on its path to orbit. Fuel warnings were chiming across his visor display from the faltering jump pack turbines. He saw the armored form of Galerius desperately beckoning to him from the open ramp. The shuttle's engines darkened, the craft's escape velocity dipping marginally.
Brother! Give it everything you have! We can allow you a few seconds more!
Esau didn't hesitate. He opened the pack thrusters to full, aiming his trajectory up and over the soaring shuttle. Then his reserves were spent. For the space of a few heartbeats, he felt almost weightless against the infinite horizon before his powered leap guttered into one final, sprawling tumble into gravity's deadly clutches. He had judged the angle almost perfectly, instinctively accounting for the arc of his path and the movement of the onager relative to it. Almost perfectly. Almost. Within 10 meters of the open hold, he realized that he wasn't going to make it. He was going to fall short of the ramp's edge by what could only have been a few centimeters, but might as well have been an entire world away. His open gauntlets clawed at the empty air. He felt the wash of the shuttle engines, so tantalizingly close. He saw the faces of the human passengers strapped down to their bench seats, their expressions of vertiginous terror frozen in that moment. Galerius's powerful gauntlet closed around his wrist. With an almighty roar of exertion, his boots maglocked to the interior hull, the veteran heaved Esau another arm's length up, allowing him to scramble over the lift and into the hold. The two of them lay panting on the deck as the ramp ratcheted closed behind them. Esau's twin hearts thundered in his ears, and he realized that he could not have stood, even if he wanted to. The older warrior pulled off his laureled helm and let it clatter to one side. He managed a wide smile.
That was an untidy landing, brother. You should work on that.
Esau released his jump pack harness and rolled onto his hands and knees. Out beyond Nalyatov's cramped cockpit space, he could see the flame-streaked blue sky darkening into the void ahead of them, and the first bioships of the Tyranid swarm that hung against it. The shuttle bumped and struggled with the ascent, but Aratus, holding a communicator to his lips, was scanning the wide curve of Bracca 4's planetary thermopores.
Calling Strike Cruiser Atreides. Strike Cruiser Atreides, please respond. This is Brother Apothecary Aratus for outbound Onaga shuttle. We request immediate assistance. We have the gene seed. Repeat, we have the gene seed.
The vox crackled. The Tyranid assault was still interfering with their transmissions.
Repeat, Strike Cruiser Atreides. This is...
Onaga shuttle. This is Atreides Actual. We have your signal. Dispatching a Talon escort to bring you in.
Esau and Galerius both recognized the voice of shipmistress Hannelore. Curiously, she sounded distracted. Fraught, even.
Be advised. We are engaging Xenos vessels to buy Sergeant Quintos more time. Keep back. Maintain safe distance.
Esau rose to his feet.
Look. It's Daedalus.
The monstrous hive ship had clawed its way closer to Bracur Dominus, taking the majority of its void swarm with it. The Atreides grazed the upper edge, its guns forcing the more wary Xenos back, but having little effect on the larger and more determined bioships. Esau gritted his teeth. He knew that the war against Hive Fleet Kraken was far from over.
Before is faded, indistinct. This is by design, the whim of my masters who have ascended me. With each passing day, the life I was born into frays, soon to be forgotten. Yet still, the memory of hunger endures. The chapter will excise the past from my mind, but they have yet to take it from my stomach. Perhaps this too is by design. Hunger. That insistent tightening of the flesh as it demands nourishment is as constant a presence on Pozol as the beat of your heart. The experience of hunger, true hunger, never leaves you.
Toka, Adoni.
I look to the matriarch as we wait in darkness. We are both obscured, covered in the black dust of Pozol, as though we were birthed from it. I focus on her eyes, bright twin halos of white, shining with focus on the hunt. Three sleeps we have tracked our prey across the plains after separating him from his tribe, encircling him, drawing close, and falling back, letting him believe we had lost his scent and that it was safe to rest and make fire. After three sleeps with nothing to sustain us, we stalk close to our quarry, seeking to end our famine while we still have the strength to do so. I think of the marrow in the prey's bones, and my stomach quivers.
Voshanit, Adoni.
She brushes across her eyes with her fingertips in the old way, and I do the same. In the dark, I see her, and she sees me. The length of chipped bone in my hand is heavy, slick in my tiny grip. We make ready to strike, her moving close on the left, while I spiral wide to the right. There, I wait. Until my huntress moves, I am stone. I can see the prey clearer now. He is crouched, the nodes of his spine rising and falling in rhythm with exhausted breaths. His head snaps up and around at any noise. Paranoia, warring against the urge for sleep. A napped flint hand axe lies beside him, just within his reach. He is staring into the flames of the small fire he started, and by this, he has sealed his fate. The light has stolen his night vision, and he doesn't see the matriarch until she is already upon him. I bound across the lightless rock of the plain, loping towards the two grappling figures. I focus on the dark side of their bodies, averting my gaze from the flames as I leap. My weight on the prey's back unbalances him. I aim my blade for the join between skull and spine, just as my matriarch has taught me. A vicious thrill fills me, but neither of us are raving savages as we close the hunt. We are careful not to rupture any organs, to avoid leaking the contents of his body and poisoning the meat. We dare not cut the throat and waste the life-sustaining blood to spill out upon the ground. Our prey gives everything he has to refuse us, to survive. But as soon as my blade enters him, the outcome is no longer in doubt. My blade's tip finds the space between skull and spine and separates the prey's brain from his body.
Adone, Ikoroga!
We work quickly to dispatch him. This is not from any thought of mercy, a concept I would later learn but never actually express. Rather, it was from pragmatism, the true king of Pozo. Suffering taints the meat. The fire's touch will cleanse the prey's flesh and save us from the sickness that comes from consuming it raw. But hunger frays my patience. I take some of the prey then, holding it up in offering to my huntress first. She accepts it, as is her right. A murmur bubbles from her lips, honoring the man whose life we took to prolong our own. I look back down, my mind going again to the marrow within the bones. I plan to eat my fill when my destiny intervenes. Something huge and black roars in the midnight sky. The shock of it allows my mind only the impression of incredible size, of a pair of bladed wings. I have never seen its like before, though I have heard the legends of them whispered by the eldest of the tribe around the fires. It is a dragon. I did not have any other word to describe it yet. The monstrous thing kills the fire of our prey as the embers scatter, leaving flames of its own in its wake that make my eyes burn. blind, I do not see the smaller shapes that fall away from the beast, like it is ridding itself of lice. My vision returns to see the dragon's children. They are giants in slab black skin, their eyes blazing like the roasting pyres.
Adoni! Dosa King Vayal!
I hear her scream for me to run, but the giants bear an inconceivable terror in every movement that numbs my face and steals the strength from my legs. My eyes lock to what covers their bodies, the only aspect of them that I can understand. Human bones. They reach for me with blackened claws. I imagine their desire for my flesh, their own hunger, as the dragon screams in the night above me. Aside the past in favor of what lies before me. It is a sphere of jade floating silent and serene in the void. A lush world crowded with life. To one who has only known the barren rock of Pozol and the blessed bone of the Basilica Mortis, it is as alien to me as those I have been sent to kill.
It's so green.
Matthias is, as I am, young and shivering on the observation deck of our chapter's warship, the Endless Night. Our scars are still fresh, our bodies still growing and shifting with the recent gifts bestowed by our masters. We look out upon this new world with faces bare of any sign of accomplishment.
All of that, those are trees. Can you imagine such a thing?
I have never seen a tree before. I reach out. The world before me feels close enough to touch. My hand stops, arrested by the cold of the armadlass, keeping us from the void.
No, but soon we won't have to.
Why do they not simply burn them out?
The question is honest. Zolt is the swiftest of us, his face adorned with the sleek skull of a slain Eldar warrior. Unmatched in blade work, I bear as many scars from him as I do from my transformations.
Burn them. If the alien uses the jungles to hide, then take away its hiding place.
He shrugs, as if his words have decided something. Sergeant Baldessar's voice is gravel, even and calm, where eagerness and naivete still saturate ours. Our keeper's face is the skull of an orc laid over a ceramite helm, the trophy taken in the battle that granted him passage into the chapter. It displays his importance, whereas Matthias and I will go into battle bareheaded. Expendable. Those who wear their trophy masks into battle have names within our order. Matthias and I, the Faceless, do not.
Why will we not burn this world?
It has become a lesson.
The environment has value.
Matthias was chosen the same night as I. Together, we survived the first trials, living where so many others were given to the incinerators, forgotten for their failure. On Pozol, time would have seen one of us as predator, the other prey. Here, as servants of the chapter, we are brothers.
This world is a resource to be cultivated, not wasted.
Time.
Cornell speaks through the shattered jaws of a dead pirate king. He is the eldest neophyte, a blooded scout, and the closest to casting off the rank of novitiates and joining the chapter's battle companies.
If they have called for aid, then they lack the means to raise so much jungle on their own before they are undone.
I realize that Baldassare is looking to me now, leering through a greenskin's bones for my thoughts.
And you?
My pulse quickens as the eyes of the squad bore into me.
Because we are here, we are the fire.
A controlled blaze. Good. We will not scorch your world because these Xenos are an infestation, not an existential threat. You do not rid your tent of pests by burning it down. You find where they hide, and you purge them.
I avoid Zolt's glare, my eyes low and away, to ignore the unblinking gaze of the Eldar Phantom.
We will find the Xenos that infest this world, and we shall exterminate them. That is why we are here.
Indeed, Brother Sergeant.
Astador is the last to step onto the observation deck, dwarfing us all with his power-armored bulk. His face is the grinning, flensed skull of a space marine, polished bone that pronounces his station as chaplain rather than a trophy won in battle.
Behold, the jungles of Aztlan. The mortals of the Imperium have called for aid, and so the Chapter Master has honored the ancient pact we hold with this world. They have an enemy they cannot overcome, and we have young warriors fresh from the apothecary's slabs in need of blooding. A confluence.
He gestures to us with the Crozius Arcanum chained to his arm, sweeping its golden blades over each of us.
Now come. Our audience with the Emperor awaits.
We kneel in a circle around the fire. The sense of being aboard a vessel in the void shrinks away in the meditation chamber. The endless night's corridors of iron and plasteel exchanged for stone, its low-powered lumen strips replaced by a simple open pyre. Save for the armor we wear, there is no technology here. Nothing to dissuade the notion that we dwelt in a shaman's lodge in some savage land. For a moment, it feels like Pozul, like the home I am slowly failing to remember.
We join here in the ancient way, to commune with the Ultimum Bellator.
The chaplain speaks the ritual words, and the squad draws its flensing blades as one.
As warriors, we offer tribute to entreat his radiance.
I ran the edge of my knife along my palm. We let the blood fall into the pyre until the scent of blood smoke fills the chamber. Astador takes a measure of powder from a vial on his belt, adding it to our offering. The air takes on an acrid edge, blurring with the blood to form a kind of incense.
Look into the flames.
I obey him, though the light hurts my eyes. It is not punitive, this pain, but necessary. War is blood and pain, and so it is through blood and pain that our communion shall occur. I take incense in, and a tingling creeps over my flesh. The feeling begins to seep out of my limbs, a gentle numbness. As the chaplain intones the rites of meditation in the tongue of old Pozul, the corners of my vision begin to waver.
Koren va nola dunesar. Koren va nola dunesar.
instant seems to stretch. An infinite corridor of repeating light. I no longer feel attached to my body. I have no weight. I look to my squad within the circle. Each of them blazes a light like pyres of golden majesty. It is the touch of the Ultimum Bellator, the master of mankind, bestowing the gift of his glory upon my brethren. I turn my gaze upon my own hands and see only darkness. There is no favor shown to me. There is only blackness, oblivion, and nothingness. I feel a weight crush into my chest, the sensation of falling, falling, falling. The moment ends, snapping back like elastic. Feeling returns in a slow ebb, the cold of the stone beneath me, the spice of the incense. I raise my head, confronted by the chaplain and his skull face.
What did you see?
I saw each of my brothers bathed in the light of the Ultimum Bellator, but no such radiance touched me. Panic laces my soul. Feeling has yet to return to my hands. I look to Astador, eyes stinging as the world drops away from beneath me. Am I beneath his gaze, Master? Am I damned? For a long moment, the chaplain is silent. I feel his stare bore into me, measuring every facet of me, to judge my worthiness.
We shall see, Faceless. We shall see.
We finally touch the surface of Aztlan. The familiar sounds of the base, boots and soldiers and machines, are lost to me, eclipsed by the environment that surrounds us. The sheer amount of moisture in the air is shocking to me. The sweltering vegetation, the mingling scents of billions of living things. I look up, marveling at the sky, not shrouded in unending darkness, but of a stunning, blistering blue, streaked by wispy banks of cloud. A glance at Matthias tells me he is similarly unbalanced by it.
Now we don't have to imagine it.
My body has been transformed to adapt to these changes, to thrive in any environment. But my mind takes more time to adjust to a world so filled with sights, sounds, smells, and light. The disruption cannot undo the happiness I feel within. This world is precious to me. I will either gain a name within the chapter on Aztlan, or I will die here. A mortal in rumpled jungle fatigues awaits us, holding his cap to his head as our thunderhawk lifts off. The small honor guard arrayed behind him grip their weapons tightly to their chests. Our sergeant looks over his shoulder at us.
Most mortals live their entire lives without witnessing one of the Adeptus Astartes, and we are likely far different than the statues and stained glass heroes they adored as children.
He turns back, stepping forward as the human officer makes the sign of the Aquila.
I am Major Grin, 451st Rakothian Air Cavalry. In the name of the Emperor, I bid you welcome to Aztlan.
Baldessar leads us forward, scattering the honor guard to either side of us. He maintains his stride across the landing pad, forcing the Major to jog beside him to keep pace.
I must confess my surprise at your arrival. When Command sent the call for assistance here, I had never imagined they would send space marines.
Baldassar stops, only now craning down to look the man in the eye. He gestures to us.
These are not space marines.
The human hesitates, unsure of how to respond. The calculus of questioning one of the Emperor's angels of death takes very little time for his mind to process. He forces a nervous smile, burying it in a hurried nod.
Yes, of course. As you say,
Sergeant.
Sergeant, yes. We are grateful for the support of your chapter in whatever form it takes.
Tell me of the Xenos.
The bastard Tau. These jungles are riddled with them. Any intelligence we have gathered suggests they are present in proportionately small numbers. But their operational methods are such that they have eluded our efforts to close with and destroy them.
The Tau is craven by nature, Major. But their cowardice cannot save them. Not any longer.
The base is a broad square of sun-baked rockcrete, an island amongst the trees. Rows of barracks fill one side, with the landing pad behind us, and the vehicle yard and marshalling ground ahead. Observation towers punctuate the walls. Sniper teams scanning the flattened kill zones that had been hacked and burned clear from the jungle. I look up to see a pair of aircraft high above, cutting through the clouds. My eyes are drawn back down to a scene developing just inside the base's main gate. A weary soldier stumbles towards the checkpoint, weaponless and bloodstained. I can tell from his gait and face that he is in severe pain, clutching at his abdomen. He collapses, drawing those on guard duty and nearby comrades to come to his aid. They cut open his fatigues, revealing a trail of rough stitches along his torso. A medical chimera comes to a stop at the gathering. White-robed personnel disembark, laden with equipment. The soldier begins to convulse. I can almost see what will unfold before it happens. The blast is strong enough to cook off the Chimera's fuel cells and shatter its hull, sending shrapnel spinning for meters in all directions. A column of thick smoke climbs the sky. Men and women stagger around the crater, maimed and screaming.
Animals!
The Major looks back at us, his face screwed up in rage, before he runs towards the blast site.
We are fighting animals!
Emergency response and Medicaid teams rush towards the carnage, fighting the fires and pulling their comrades back. Baldassar does not move, and so neither do we, clinging behind him like his shadow.
So they capture a soldier, incapacitate him, fill his body with an explosive, and then turn him loose. He believes he has escaped and then returns here to unwittingly deliver the bomb. Clever.
Only if that is the truth. How could you know such a thing for certain?
Because subterfuge and ambush are these creatures' proclivities, brother. And because, were I in their position, it is exactly what I would do.
Do not look upon the world through the eyes of a Xenos, brother.
Zolt taps the skull laid over his own.
Just this one.
I take a step closer. My eyes fall over the sizzling bodies. The smell of roasting flesh fills my nose. I close my eyes as it washes over my tongue, a tantalizingly familiar sensation. I look up at the green-skinned skull leering over me.
You will focus, faceless.
The sergeant stalks away, and Matthias hauls me to my feet. Cornell and Zolt say nothing as we follow behind our leader.
Major.
My lord.
My sergeant's posture shifts, the movement too subtle for the mortal to see, in irritation at the title.
Sergeant, that charge was triggered remotely.
Meaning the saboteur must still be nearby. Vox!
A soldier hurries towards us, handing the bulky Vox set on his back to Gren.
Kilo 4, this is Falcon's Talon. Request fire mission all channels. Possible sighting of enemy element. Broad sweep of fire from grids 2-1 all the way to 4-9. Sustained barrage. I want that entire tree line gone. Now!
Eager for vengeance, the base comes alive. Every weapon is swung towards the jungle-ridden hillside beyond the camp's walls. Artillery officers call out coordinates to saturate the entire area with shellfire. The terminology springs into my mind from the Blessed Primarch's Codex. Reconnaissance by fire. The full might of the Astra Militarum's arsenal opens up, drenching the hillside in fire like horizontal neon rain. They hope to draw the shooter out or destroy a wide enough swathe of our surroundings to kill the Xenos they cannot see. I frown. If it were I in that jungle, I would already have displaced long before they had ever started their fusillade. A pair of lightning strike fighters punctuate the barrage with a gun run, lending rockets and bombs to leave nothing standing across nearly a square kilometer of once verdant jungle, now a blazing ruin.
Impressive. A waste, albeit an entertaining one.
Right. Now we begin.
Brother Sergeant?
If that Xenos is of any skill, the garrison's barrage didn't kill it. Nor did it need to serve our purpose.
He points past the tract of jungle that was now a scorched ash plain into the narrow region just beyond.
What it did achieve is block off any other way the enemy could escape and force them into that valley. That is now our hunting ground.
The Valkyrie is cramped and small compared to our Thunderhawk, a more fragile transport for a more fragile soldier. I watch one, a man strapped to the heavy stubber hanging off the gunship's hip. He makes a habit of stroking his fingers along the belt of linked shells that feed into the cannon, wide-eyed and nervous and reeking of low-grade stims and fear sweat. It is not inexperience that brings on his fear. The kill markers etched into the temples of his crash helm in uneven rows of silver scratches disprove that. Perhaps experience is the very reason for his fear. He sees me watching him. My eyes are red, far from a unique trait on Posel, yet different enough to cause discomfort in most I encounter. He looks away. I do not understand his fear, not anymore. Such a capacity was taken from me, replaced with conviction and an unyielding purpose. War, the source of his fear, is what I am made for. The gunner cuffs the sweat dripping from his nose as the gunship slows, breathing through his teeth and panning his weapon in quick sweeps over the jungle.
Come on out, Blueskin. Come on out. I've got Miss Painless here, all dressed up and ready for you.